This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Florida. I'm a big water guy, so every time I come to Tampa, I got to get out in the water. My next guy knows all about the water because he gets in it.
That's right.
He does. He's the associate curator for the Florida Aquarium. Eric Hovland, how are you, sir?
I'm doing terrific. Thanks for having me, Peter.
You're also a shark guy.
Oh, yeah. Sharks are my passion. I'm the shark guy.
All right. But do we have sharks at the aquarium?
We do have sharks at the aquarium. We have a number of sharks at the aquarium, from the tiny bamboo sharks all the way up to our sand tiger sharks. And in fact, there's a really cool relationship between those sharks.
And nurse sharks.
And we have nurse sharks, too.
Yeah. I went swimming with the nurse sharks in the Galapagos.
Fantastic.
And they were the tamest. They just were fearless and friendly.
They are. You know, and that's actually true of most of the sharks that are out there. Sharks kind of get a bum rap. They get some bad press, and that's why, you know, people ask me, like, Eric, why sharks? And I say, because everyone already loves dolphins. They need to love sharks, too. It's a world I want to live in.
Flipper. Okay, sorry.
Yes.
But bottom line is, you have to know the difference between sharks.
It helps to understand sharks. It helps to understand that sharks are, you know, when we're entering their environment, we're really entering their environment where man is out of his element, because you've got a whole other dimension of up and down and the surprise.
Now, you're originally from Wisconsin, not known for sharks.
Not so much. We're pretty short on sharks in Wisconsin, although a bull shark has been caught as far north as Illinois. So there's a little factoid for you.
How'd he get there?
He swam.
I know that, but I mean, he's not native to that location.
Bull sharks can move into freshwater. They can regulate their blood chemistry, so they can actually move into freshwater environments around the world. That's one of the reasons they've gotten a rap, is because bull sharks are in places you might not expect them to be. But it's not a reason to freak out over sharks.
Well, moving beyond sharks and getting into a definition of terms, you know, there are amusement parks that feature sea life, and then there's an aquarium. It's a big difference.
There is, in that the aquarium, and especially what we're known for at the Florida Aquariums, we're engaging folks in the backyards that they didn't even realize they have. The wilds of Florida. Florida is surrounded 3/4 by water. We have more coastline than just about any other state. And we're so dependent on water, from the 100 million guests that come to Florida every year to all the wildlife out there, which, you know, provides not just food and entertainment and sport, but the very air that we breathe comes from healthy coral reef environments. About every other breath, you should say, thank you, sharks and healthy coral reefs. That's where the oxygen is produced.
Well, from an educational level then, what am I going to learn at the aquarium in Tampa that I would never otherwise get?
You're going to learn at the aquarium about the diversity of species that's out there. A lot of people are already thinking about just what you said, flipper there. They might have sharks on the mind. But even learning that something like corals, like the staghorn corals, are so prevalent in the coral reefs of Florida 20 years ago and are on a fast decline. Well, we have a program at the Florida Aquarium that can help people better understand how we're helping to, you know, grow those corals in our setting of our coral conservation or Center for Conservation, and help protect those coral reefs and how important those are to everybody on the planet. And the things that you can do to make, you know, a commitment to helping protect our waterways,
but
even
you
like
actually,
cutting out plastics.
But you actually have to make a firm commitment. I remember when I was growing up on the East Coast in Long Island on the Great South Bay, there was an abundance of oysters, an abundance of clams, an abundance of seafood you could never run out. Well, guess what?
Yeah, it's running out.
Well, not only was it overfished and overclammed, then we had Hurricane Sandy. And what Hurricane Sandy did is it tore up the seabed.
Right.
And it tore up the seabed so that the clams were and the oysters were no longer protected from the crabs that wanted to eat them.
Yeah.
And as a result, it's almost empty now.
And that's what I think we're learning, too. We've seen the same kind of results that when hurricanes do hit a coastline, if you remove the natural barriers there, like the mangrove forests that are so prevalent here in Florida, you take that away, now the water can wash completely over the land. It made a big difference in Katrina. It made a big difference in Ike and Galveston. And then you see that, too. If you develop a coastline and you don't leave some of those natural barriers there and those healthy beaches there,
you're going to lose a lot more.
You pay the cost in the end, yeah.
What's the most fascinating exhibit you have there?
I would say...
And probably, don't say sharks.
No. That would be way too biased. The Wetlands Gallery and the Wetlands Habitat. It is a glass dome. It's enormous, and it houses a whole home and a host of animals from free-flighted spoonbills that have been making a comeback in Tampa Bay, which is a sign of a healthy, recovering environment, but they're making a comeback in our very dome. We've got babies from 2 years ago that are still, you know, flying around the habitat, but we've got alligators and otters and fish of all types from Florida. It really is, and it's a mangrove forest that's over 20 years old. I've been happy enough to be there over 20 years myself and watch those grow from their little sprouts to 30-foot tall mangroves. It is truly a living home and habitat.
And the thing is, not only do you see that growth, when you come in there and you tell that story and you put it in perspective, then people can really respect that.
And that's what we are doing, is connecting people with the wilds. They've got to learn the stories of every one of these animals. And from the sharks to the turtles that we rescue and release every year, to the corals that we're doing our very best to protect so that we can still protect that environment for generations to come.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
My next guest, like so many other people I know, came to Tampa by accident. It wasn't part of the plan. He was trying to get into the Navy. They washed him out as a fighter pilot, and he took his $200 discharge money, got into, what kind of car was that?
A 1966 Dodge Dart with no air conditioning.
As it should be.
And one suit, and nowhere else to go.
And drove to Tampa. Well, guess what? In 2011, he got elected mayor. His name is Bob Buckhorn. Mr. Mayor, thanks for coming.
Peter, thanks. Thanks for coming back to Tampa.
And you're still here.
I am still here. It was the best decision I ever made.
But it was just like prompted by the Navy.
It did. Broke my heart because I had always aspired to be a fighter pilot. And when they misdiagnosed me and discharged me, it forced me to Plan B, which there was no Plan B.
Are we now changing the name of Tampa to Plan B?
I guess so. It's you know, it's not often that someone who doesn't grow up in a city or spend most of their life is able to get elected mayor.
Aren't you the first one?
I think if not the first, I'm pretty close.
Yeah.
But I think what it speaks to is Tampa's ability to welcome talent and even less talented folks like me to be a part of this community. I mean, there were no barriers for entry for me. You know, I scratched and clawed and fought hard to get here, but no one stood in my way and said, you're not born and raised here. You're not a Tampanian by birth, so therefore you can't be the mayor. They said, no, give it your best shot, son.
And here we are in the third largest city in Florida.
Absolutely, and the 53rd largest city in America.
But who's counting?
Yeah, me.
Well, let me say, speaking of large cities, and I said this to you off air, but I'm going to say it to you on air, I love your airport.
Thanks.
The Tampa Airport, for those people who have not flown here, you're in for a pleasant surprise. For people who have flown here, you already know what I'm talking about. It's actually an airport that works.
You know, Peter, we're very proud of that airport, and I think the folks that fly through there recognize what an amazing place it is. It's always rated as one of the highest user-friendly, traveler-friendly airports. And what folks will be happy to know is that we're in the midst of a billion-dollar expansion with another $2 billion phase two coming over the next 2 years. So,
yeah, but don't change what works.
No, we're not. We're not. And that's really a model for, and if you can imagine this, that design has been timeless, basically, and other airports have used that design. And what's ironic about this is the sons of the original architect that designed that airport are working now on phase one and phase two of the expansion.
All right. So you've been here since what year?
1982.
Okay. So you've seen the airport grow.
I have.
What makes it still work, though? What about the design of that airport says to you, this is cool?
It's convenient. Ease of use is absolutely there. We get you, and it was the first shuttle system that was at an airport.
From the terminals.
Yeah. And so that shuttle system gets you to baggage claim rapidly, and it gets you right out to your car. So the time that you are in that airport, as you were saying earlier, is minimal. And what we're attempting to do with the expansion is to give you more food offerings, give you more retail offerings, to make the experience more pleasant than it already is for you. But I think you're absolutely right. It is the design of that airport that makes it unique.
And it's only, what, 15 minutes away?
It is. 15 minutes from downtown Tampa.
Amazing. What's the thing that changed in Tampa that you think is the, other than the airport, the coolest thing going?
You know, we came out of this recession that had literally knocked us to our knees. And we had to make a fundamental decision as to whether we were going to get up off the mat and come back. And we did. And I think the transformation of this city over the last 6 years has been nothing more than absolutely amazing. You know, Tampa's got a swagger about it. Tampa's got an attitude about it that's not cocky, but that recognizes that we are a city with immense potential. And our mission is to fulfill that potential. And we've been through our ups and downs. You know, you remember when we were declared America's next great city in the late 80s, and we didn't quite get there. But I think
And you didn't quite get there then because?
Because I think leadership, I think the economy, I think there were conflicting and competing views about what it took to be in that top tier of cities. I mean, we're not competing with New York or L.A. We're competing with emerging Sunbelt cities.
Every mayor wants growth.
You know, the Austin, Texas's, right? And the Charlotte, North Carolinas, and the Nashville's, and the San
Diego's.
You've
got to make sure it's the right
We're competing
growth.
For
you
talent.
Make sure it's the kind
we're
of jobs that
for,
allow our
capacity.
Best and brightest
we're
to remain here. I mean, I've got two young kids. I don't want them
well
to have to leave for some other city. So the type of growth that occurs is important, and how you manage it.
Are you seeing kids leaving?
We were 6 or 7 years ago. They were fleeing. We were a donor state and a donor city to other places that had really gotten their act together. That has changed completely. I mean, young people are flocking back to Tampa in droves. So I worry less about our ability to compete because we can do that. What I worry about is rampant growth, unregulated growth, growth without infrastructure accompanying it. And so, you know, we have a great niche here. We don't need to be the biggest city in America. We're not going to be the biggest city.
You don't want to be.
No, we don't. Absolutely not. But I do want to be the economy that's driving the southeast United States south of Atlanta. And I think we're capable of doing that. Big international port, big international airport, a very diverse community that celebrates diversity as a strength, not as a weakness. So I think we've got the capacity to do it, but you're absolutely right, Peter. How you manage that and how you plan for that is absolutely important.
You mentioned the port. Have you wrapped that up?
We have, on both the cargo side and as well as on the cruise ship side. I mean, it is the largest deepwater port in the state of Florida by a long stretch. Port Miami is only 900 acres. Port Tampa Bay is 5,000 acres. So we have a lot of room for growth. We just invested in two new gantry cranes. We are the closest port to the Panama Canal, which has obviously been widened.
Yeah, get out your maps, boys and girls, and just do a straight line from Tampa, and you're going to hit Panama.
Absolutely. And so we potentially have the ability to be the gateway to Central and South America for different reasons than Miami. Miami's got its own niche, but I think we have the capacity to do that. We speak the language. We're a multicultural community, and we're proud of that, and we celebrate that. So it's a city that's on the rise, a city that is on the verge of something really, really special.
Plus, you've got ships now sailing from Tampa to Cuba.
We do indeed. We have, I think you're going to be on one of them shortly, and that is going to open up that market. Although, I will tell you, it will be a long time before Cuba is a significant trading partner for the state of Florida or for the country. Their ability to pay, their ability to get credit is limited.
Yeah.
Until there are fundamental changes in the government, I don't think you're going to see real freedoms occur. But, you know, it starts with people to people. It starts with educational exchanges, and that's happening.
You know, we talked about the airport. Let's talk about airlift, because without airlift, it doesn't matter how good the airport is, you suffer. If you take a look at the airlines that we have in America, I'm talking about the legacy carriers. We've gone from 8 major carriers that used to fight for 88% of the market share down to 4 of them that essentially own it. So your challenge, as many challenges are to other mayors like you, is how do you keep the airlift even at the level it's at, let alone how do you increase it?
Well, what we have tried to do over the last 6 years is expand that capacity and to put Tampa on the global map. We did not have international flights of any significance 6 years ago.
So we made it.
But you are an international airport.
We are. And we made it a mission for the last 6 years to go out and recruit international flights to come to Tampa. We were successful with Copa Airlines, which really opened up Central and South America.
And we've done a story on Copa. If you look at the map, if you think you can't get there from here, if you don't mind going through Panama City, Panama, right? Guess what? You're there.
It opens up the entire Central and South America. And they told us no for 3 years, and we dogged the CEO,
Pedro.
Love Pedro.
See, I know Pedro. There you go.
We dogged him for 3 or 4 years until we were able to make the case to him. And it was a very data-driven case as to why Tampa made sense. We've expanded airlines with Icelandic Air, with Edelweiss Air. We are aggressive about it. We're incentivizing these airlines to come here. And once they look at the numbers and they see the reach in this Tampa Bay area, and it doesn't compete with Orlando. This is an entirely different marketplace. It's an easy decision for them. So I think we're expanding our offerings, expanding our routes domestically and internationally, and I think it will bode well for us.
And yet the distance between Tampa and Orlando is no big deal.
It's not. It's 90 miles. It's an entirely separate market. We attract a lot of people who fly into Orlando for the theme parks but then want to come to the beaches down here. So we're actually advertising in Orlando with a campaign that calls Tampa the Bay Area Orlando's Beaches. And it's working.
Well, you know what? It's not one-dimensional anymore.
It's not.
I mean, people can bookend.
They can indeed, and it's easy to rent a car and come down here and experience the beaches and then go back to the theme parks.
What have you done in terms of your own building codes here to make sure that you don't become out of control in terms of development?
Well, it's interesting. We're trying to focus most of the development in the urban core where the infrastructure is already in place. I mean, our downtown has just exploded in growth, but that's a good thing. That's where you have the density. That's where you can go higher. That's where the infrastructure is in place. We finished the Riverwalk. I mean, it is a very different downtown, Peter, than it was even a year ago when you were here before. You know, we're obviously moving to green codes and encouraging people to build to LEED certified standards. So we really are being smart about this. We don't want the sprawl that takes place when people move to where the dirt's cheaper or where you drive till you can qualify for a mortgage. We want the bulk of the growth to occur in the urban core because I will tell you, if we're going to attract millennials and if we're going to attract intellectual capital, those young people want to live in the urban core. They don't want to live in the burbs. So we have to build a downtown that's attractive to them. Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. My next guest doesn't have to go all around the world to have a great dining and eating experience because he's the food and dining editor of the Miami Herald, and there's a new restaurant opening up here about every 13 seconds, and he's got to cover it all. What a tough job he has. Carlos Frias, how are you?
It's good to be here, Peter. It's great.
I mean, I'm never disappointed. I'm never surprised. I am amazed, though, because, I mean, the turnover, the opening, it just doesn't stop.
No, and we're catching us in the time of the season where some of those restaurants that were ambitious at the beginning of the year are now kind of tightening their belts and seeing if they can make it through to the beginning of the season, which is interesting to watch.
So basically you're Mr. Opening Night.
yeah. It's you know, get there, find out about the restaurant early, see if it's what it's all about, because if it doesn't have something special, it may not be there for long.
Well, you see the trends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's not just Cuban cuisine. It's not just, you know, or like in California, it's not just Mexican cuisine. It's everybody, right? So what are you seeing that's actually exploding here in Miami now?
You know, the thing that we're seeing the most is Peruvian. Peruvian in general, both upscale and downscale Peruvian.
Okay, so my question was, how much ceviche can you eat?
Well, it's interesting because we're seeing a lot of more of the Asian influences. So it's not just specifically Peruvian, but they're kind of reaching out to their kind of like their pan-Asian being brought into it. So like their Chinese, Japanese roots in that.
And the Peruvian.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So it's really... and
so
it's
hot and sour guinea pig.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there may be one spot that actually does guinea pig, which you'd really...
Because when I was in Peru, I couldn't show up anywhere without somebody offering me, and you couldn't say no because it would be impolite. They were giving you the guinea pig.
Exactly. And who's going to make better guinea pig than these folks, right? If
exactly.
You're going to eat it, right?
So what's the thing that's surprising you the most about what's going on in the restaurant scene here?
The most interesting thing going on right now is that it's not out-of-town chefs opening their third, fourth restaurant on Miami Beach. It's locally grown folks who are artisans and kind of exploring their craft here, whether that's artisanal breads. A guy that we know by the name of Zach the Baker, who went scouting through
Sounds like a mass murderer.
Well,
Zach the Baker.
Well, but he looks like a saint. You look at him, he looks like a saint.
He does good bread.
Oh my God, he does incredible bread. Zach the Baker in Wynwood, which is one of those exploding areas.
All right, well, when we talk about bakery, I mean, I've got friends of mine, including our engineer today, Jorge Cayon, who will tell you that nobody knows more about Cuban bread than this guy, meaning him, Jorge, right? And he will make a point of stopping everywhere he can to get that bread. You too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, there's nothing like just a café con leche and a nice toasted Cuban bread. I mean, that's like...
But what makes Cuban bread so special?
I think it's, a lot of folks try to approximate it with like French bread, but really it's the lard, right? That's really just what makes it special.
Now, there's a name for a good Cuban bakery. It's the lard.
That's what it is.
I mean, look, you go to Montreal, they have the best bagels in the world, but their answer is it's because it's the water. Here it's the lard?
Here it's the lard, man. I mean, if you can't make a good Cuban bread without adding plenty and enough of lard.
Praise the lard. Okay. But what makes it taste differently then?
I think that it really is about these kind of long-held process of how they raise the dough and how they bake it. And like I said, it's just using good old-fashioned pig fat. It's not a complicated bread. It's just you got to have those proportions right.
I want to see that little marketing branding slogan, good old-fashioned pig fat.
I know. I mean, is there anything that pig fat doesn't make better? I contend no.
And since this is radio, I should tell you that Carlos weighs 725 pounds. No, I'm lying. I'm totally lying.
I have been told that I would come off as a more believable food critic and dining editor if I put on an extra 150 pounds. So I'm working on that.
See, I look at it the other way. You ever go to a Dunkin' Donuts store? I mean, the guys there weigh 2 pounds because they don't eat it.
Right. That's a good point.
Right.
That's a good point.
But you have to eat it.
Sample. You sample.
You sample.
Yeah.
It's sort of like wine tasting. You just spit it out.
No, I order a lot and I try lots of things and I take a lot home.
You scammer.
It's a little bit of a scam.
Yeah, you scammer. But it's not just the Cuban bread, it's the Cuban hamburger.
Yes. See,
now, that's a secret.
That is the secret. You know, if you come to Miami and you want something really distinctive and it's so low end and so accessible, it's called the frita. And it's just a Cuban hamburger. They're kind of developed in Havana, and you can find a half a dozen shops, you know, within a half mile range where you can get a good one.
Now, speaking of Cuban, I go back probably 20 years ago, I would take my friends, you're going to laugh at me, but I would take my friends who had no experience at all with Cuban food, and I figure I got to immerse them a little bit slowly. So I'd take them to the airport, to La Carreta.
Yeah.
Because that was a good introduction for them.
Sure.
Right? And then La Carreta got big, and they got famous, and they got the branches all over the airport now. So yeah, La Carreta. But you know how I discovered La Carreta? Because I did a book years ago called Flight Crew Confidential, where I interviewed about 400 different flight attendants and flight crew members, pilots as well, to tell me where they went on their layovers, right? Because they only had 24 hours, they were on a budget, everything had to have a cost effectiveness to it because they weren't making a lot of money. They always wanted to eat well.
They were Bourdain before Bourdain.
They were.
Yeah.
And every one of them who was going through Miami was saying, that's where I go. That's how I found out about it.
Oh, that's a smart. Talk to a local, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So now where do you go?
Well, for Cuban food, there's this great place where you got to go west. It's called La Fragua, and it's from the folks who originally worked with the Estefans to open the Larios on the beach. Like the same cook, and it's a 86-year-old man, his 80-year-old wife, and he's still the cook in the back, and she's still out front, and it's a great partnership. And the food is as you would expect.
Okay, so that's where you go for Cuban food.
Yep.
Where do you go? You mentioned it before, so I'll bring it up again. Where do you go for Peruvian?
You know, right around my house, there are two Aromas de Peru, Aromas of Peru. And it's almost like a family-oriented small chain, and it's really just great Peruvian food. And there's a place that all Peruvians love that, again, you got to go west. It's called Dr. Limon. Because he used to make these cocktails that were like hangover cures, and they were ceviche based. So Peruvians who live in Miami that just love Peruvian go to that place way out in Kendall.
And they take a designated driver.
I don't speak for other folks, but they should. They should definitely take an Uber.
We're talking to Carlos Frias, the food and dining editor at the Miami Herald. All right, so we've dealt with Cuban, we've dealt with Peruvian. Is there such a thing as great French food in Miami?
Great French, well, there is a really well-reviewed restaurant. We just reviewed a restaurant called Le Petit Maison, which is here in, I want to say, in Miami Beach. And it got our reviewer, Victoria Pesha, Pesha Elliott, gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars. She really loved it. And she is a real connoisseur of French cuisine, and she loved it.
So the answer to the question is yes, you can find it.
Yes, you can find it.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Barbecue?
Barbecue that's in tough. South Florida
it's
is
tough.
Tough. But I will tell you, there's a spot called, and it's you have to drive a little north. It's in Broward. It's called Blue Willie's. And it used to be just kind of in this little hole in the wall. It just moved to a slightly bigger space. But if you're going to, it's probably where you can get the best down-home barbecue. And there's another place called Smoke, which you can find.
Appropriately titled.
Yeah, which, again, solid barbecue.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more. It's the feet of man who walks 1,000 miles to fall down at your door.
Now, I've been coming to Orlando since the 70s, and some might argue Orlando's only been coming to Orlando since the 70s, but we'll get to that later. And when I first came here, people were talking about, oh, you want to go to this great restaurant in Old Town? I said, how far back does Old Town go? They said, oh, like 1958. I said, wow. So there's an interesting relative moment to the definition of the word history here. And then if you're not careful, you know, it is true because Americans have a certain comfort level when they travel. Every imaginable fast food franchise you could think of is here and everywhere in Orlando. And yet, Orlando has evolved and quite remarkably and quite happily into quite a food scene. And joining me now, who's the food critic and the restaurant critic of Orlando Weekly, is Fayaz Kara. How are you, sir?
Very good. How are you?
Well, you heard my intro here. I mean, in the old days, it was, you know, Arby's and Wendy's and, you know, not a whole lot of stuff. And now there's a great Lebanese place. There are French places. There's great sushi. I mean, Disney for years had the worst food ever. And then they got smart at the roof of the Contemporary Resort.
Mm-hmm.
They built what?
They built the California Grill.
Which was, it's actually great. I mean, you know, you never used to say Disney food and great in the same sentence. But they did a good job.
Yeah, I mean, they had a real concerted effort in the mid to late 90s, I would say,
yeah,
to really elevate the city's food
scene.
And by
the way, they had nowhere to go but up.
Right.
I mean, let's be real.
Yeah. I remember when I moved here in 99, I saw it as a bit of a cultural and culinary wasteland, because as you were saying, it was very homogenous in terms of its, chain restaurants everywhere. But I would say in the last 5 years, we've seen a real, as you said, a real evolution in the, a maturation even of the city's food scene. It's been sort of incredible. I don't think I would have ever predicted it after moving here in 99 and seeing what we, you know, the choices that we had. But it has been nothing short of incredible, really.
So what have been the big surprises for you?
The big surprises is the diversity of options. You know, I grew up in Toronto, and I...
By the way, if you grew up in Toronto, this is wild, and you weren't expecting me to tell you this. But I discovered, in the days where I used to eat meat, and I used to eat meat a lot. I haven't had meat now in 9 years, but in the days that I did, the best steakhouse in North America was in Toronto, but it wasn't what you would think. It was actually a Chinese restaurant on Eglinton called the House of Chan.
No way.
Yeah. I mean, unbelievable. Nobody went there for the egg roll. You went there for the steaks. And it was just amazing. So there's always those kinds of surprises.
When was that?
Oh, God. That started 20 years ago until they lost their lease about 4 years ago and had to move. And they've just reopened. I just heard the other day they're actually back. Now, of course, I'm not eating meat anymore, but I'm telling you, you want a great ribeye, you go to that. You know, this Chinese restaurant
the
called
House of Chan.
House of Chan.
I'm going to check it out next time
I go. In Toronto, yeah.
Yeah, and if you're not eating meat anymore, there is a great restaurant that's open downtown called Sanctum Cafe. And they've taken vegan, vegetarian food and, you know, elevated it.
Well, by the way, I'm sorry, folks, if I'm insulting you, but vegan food insults me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's and by the way, did you ever, okay, now I'm going to get people mad now, but I'm going to say it anyway. You walk into a vegan restaurant, you ever notice that people talk there like escaped librarians? They're all like, would you like the kale? It's like they're like the people from the pods, you know. It's like why are they whispering?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, we have special tofu. Thank you.
We're going to add fuel to the fire, because I always thought they weren't the most healthiest looking folks around
either. They looked a little pale. I get it. I totally support the idea, but you're not going to find me. There's this vegan restaurant that a friend of mine took me to in New York. It was painful for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's our vegan bacon. It's like, what? You know, no. You either get the high test or you don't get it at all.
Okay.
We'll get to vegan later, all right? Fias, don't go there.
Okay.
Although we just went there.
We just went there.
I know.
It'll be edited out.
Tell me the surprises. No, it will not be edited out. It's all in.
Well, I was talking about the diversity of options. You know, when I moved here, everything was very homogenous, very, very one-dimensional, very chain-heavy. And then all of a sudden I'm eating really good, you know, South Indian fare. I'm eating incredible Vietnamese cuisine. I'm eating, like, as you were just talking about, you know, this, you know, like French food. We've seen Dovecote Brasserie and Urban 40. You know, so we're seeing such diversity, and it's not a one-dimensional diversity either. Like, you know, when people talk about Miami being very cosmopolitan and diverse, but, you know, I've always kind of viewed Miami as sort of being almost like a one-dimensional diversity.
You just said Miami.
I did.
But we're talking Orlando.
We are talking Orlando. So just comparing, you know, Orlando and Miami, I see our options as being truly diverse. I can go and get really good Trinidadian roti, you know, and I can get just as good, you know, modern American fare from a celebrity chef. I mean, for a city this size, we're very, very versatile, and I can't think of any other city that can lay claim to that, you know, to that accolade.
I got one.
Mm-hmm.
New York. Come on.
Yeah, but of similar size.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we have all the celebrity restaurants, celebrity chef restaurants, and then we have really good chef-driven independent restaurants. You know, all our James Beard-nominated chefs, you know, aren't really in the tourist sector here.
They're in the community.
They're in downtown Orlando. They're in the little neighborhoods surrounding downtown. They're in Winter Park, you know.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk about those two words you just mentioned, celebrity chefs. We're living in a world now where everybody is a celebrity chef.
Mm-hmm.
And from a branding point of view, you know, you have a physical limitation about how many restaurants you can be in humanly
right.
at any one time.
Right.
So how do you keep a Michelin star? How do you keep a celebrity chef status in terms of the quality of food if you have 12 different outlets and you can't be there? So right. I want to talk about that.
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
We're talking with Fias Cara, who's the restaurant and food critic from the Orlando Weekly. You mentioned all the diversity here, which wasn't here before. I found a great Lebanese place.
Oh, yeah.
And they even have the hookah.
What Lebanese place?
It's, I knew you were going to tell me, Cedar Tree.
Cedar. Cedar's on Dr. Phillips.
Yeah, it's just a small little place, but you know, you go in there, they got the hookah pipes, and you go in there and you have all the mezza. Mm-hmm. It's like, Orlando? Really? And yeah, the answer is really.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Trinidadian.
I did mention Trinidad, but just before I get to that, another Lebanese yeah. place, Mariah Restaurant. I swear it's got the best falafel I've ever had. And I've been around.
You're a falafel guy.
I wouldn't say I'm a falafel guy, but I do love my falafel. But back to Trinidadian food. Yeah, yeah, there's a place called Singh's Roti Shop. It's on, it's not in the, I guess we can call it the less gentrified area of the city, to put it, you know, politely. And, but it serves, Trinidadian fare is a little different than Jamaican fare. It's got more,
Less jerk,
and a little bit more of the Indian influence. So their roti, they'll stuff it with, their roti is a little more puffier, less, It's got less of this dal, which is a bean of sorts. It's a dried crumbly. But anyway, it's a very puffy roti, and they fill it with all types of curries. Be it you being a non-meat eater, you'd really like the chana masala, which is chickpeas, garbanzo beans, in this very heady curry, spicy. They put the Scotch bonnet peppers in there. It's so good.
Now you mentioned Urban 40.
Yeah.
A restaurant that's been around only about a year and a half.
Right.
They do a really good... Last night I was there for dinner. I mean, I didn't expect anything. It was like... They did this charred garlic mussels. Unbelievable.
Wow.
I mean, in Orlando.
Yeah, and that's just, like I said, that's just a testament to what, the offerings that we now have that we didn't have 10 years ago. It's really, like I said, it's really been incredible.
And then, of course, there's hotel food, which used to be an oxymoron, mm-hmm. right? It used to be, steak and potatoes and room service and an old cheeseburger. And,
right.
And now, hotels realize that it's not just an afterthought. You literally have to put some effort into it and make it really worthwhile.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a Norman Van Aken's restaurant.
Well, I know Norman, yeah.
Yeah. He's probably arguably our Florida's most famous chef, and he has a restaurant, Norman's, at the Ritz-Carlton.
And Norman's been on this show many times.
Oh, has he?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's...
And by the way, I'm a non-meat eater, but his foie gras mm-hmm. at that restaurant, oh, my God. Now, how would I know that if I'm not... something happened.
Yeah, maybe had a little lapse.
Little lapse, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to get bad foie gras, I guess, but...
That's not true.
Yeah? Have you had bad foie?
I have. Have I had bad foie?
So pretentious,
man. Oh, my God, yes.
But anyway, my wife and I always have our anniversary dinner at Norman's at the Ritz-Carlton. So, we have no aversion to going to a hotel and dining on really good fare.
And, you've got Bull and Bear here, which I hang at that place.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got great seafood.
Great vegetarian offerings at Bull and Bear.
They actually do. No, they've got some great seafood.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're a pescatarian.
I am a pescatarian.
Okay. Bet.
I'm not totally crazy.
Okay.
Because if I was totally crazy, I'd be whispering like this and could have some more kale.
Yeah. Look a little more pale.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Was the word gluten even in our vocabulary 6 years ago?
Yeah, really. It, I don't think it was. Yeah. But that's also another trend. We restaurateurs.
But yeah, you talk about trend. People I know who are totally healthy are just. I like the gluten free. Really,
right.
What does gluten free mean? I don't know. I just want it.
Yeah. There's people with legitimate. Allergies.
Absolutely.
It has sort of become a bit of a trend. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but restaurateurs have to be even more aware of allergies that their customers have. Be it gluten or nuts or chili peppers, like my wife has, and that's another trend. I think we're finding that a lot of ingredients, a lot of foods that weren't typically served spicy are
right.
now being served spicy, which I love. I love chili peppers. I think so. That's another trend I'm finding.
Here's a trend: asterisks all over the menus. To just probably try to protect the restaurant and also inform you that maybe you don't want to order that.
Right, And we have to understand this is still a business. As much as we talk about, cast aspersions on chefs that have like 12 restaurants and how do they maintain the quality, it's still very much a business.
All right, well, let's talk about where you like to hang out. Because I'm one of those people who says, okay, if you're going to come to Orlando, you should rent a car. Because if you're just going to stay on a theme park property, you're disenfranchising yourself from all this other opportunity that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So in a given, let's say, 25-mile radius of where we are right now, if you're going to stay at the Waldorf Astoria for, 5 or 6 nights, you're going to eat at one of the restaurants here at least once or twice, and why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Makes sense.
Right.
And the food's great. So mm-hmm. now let's get off the property. And where would you go for breakfast, lunch, or dinner that may not be in the brochure, that may not be in the guidebook that you hang out at?
Yeah, I'll always grab, I go out to eat a lot, obviously, for what I do. But for the places I like to hang out at, I'm looking for comfort. And for me, comfort isn't necessarily, Southern comfort. For me, like I would go to Mariah for her falafel or her veggie plate, her grape leaves and her kibbeh and her unbelievable labneh. Or I would go to a place like Shiraz Market that serves Persian fare inside this little, Persian bodega. And they have the most incredible kubadeh kebabs. And, one of my favorite desserts of all time is this Iranian Persian dessert called faludeh, which is essentially iced frozen vermicelli served in this sort of rose syrup and with a lot of sugar, and you usually have it with a little squeeze of lime. It's incredible. You know, it kind of, you know, some people love it and some people hate it, but I just love it. And I'm not even Iranian.
What you just described sounds almost like a contradiction in terms.
Of comfort food or?
Just in terms of the ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't think that lime and rose water and iced vermicelli would work, but you know, it's incredible, and you can have it with a pistachio ice cream. That's all comfort.
No. It's pistachio ice cream with all other stuff on the side.
Well, actually, I like more follow day, and I like equal
amounts. Come on, you can't say.
That it is incredible too. That's what I gravitate towards. Singh's Roti Shop for some Trinidadian roti. So I'm going for that. To me, is my comfort food. Having grown up on you know, Indian food all my life. You know, I sort of gravitate towards those sorts of flavors, you know. A fried chicken, to me, while I love it, to me isn't as comforting, or meatloaf, for example.
Well, the fried chicken at the Bull and Bear is pretty good.
Yeah.
And I don't know that for a fact because I'm not eating it, but everybody tells me that.
That's what you hear. The word on the street.
I've heard. Yeah. I've heard word. I've heard things.
Yeah.
Or as Robert De Niro said, I heard stuff. I heard stuff, yeah.
Korean fried chicken, too. That's another big popular.
Korean fried chicken?
Korean fried chicken.
In Orlando.
In Orlando, yeah. There's a lot of places that don't serve it. So that's another trend, I guess. You know, Japanese fare, Pan-Asian fare, street food, you know, Asian-type street food, be it hawker style fare that you get in Malaysia or Singapore or bao or ramen.
And so many great small restaurants in the strip malls that you didn't even know about till you got there.
Right, yeah. Sometimes, you have to like just go out and explore. And I had to do a lot of that when I first moved here. But now, you know, a lot of these restaurants just tend to find you. You know, we live in this age of social media, so it's very easy to, you know, pick up on what the, you know, most popular or trending restaurant is amongst those, you know, food-conscious millennials.
So the bottom line is, rent a car, have one or two meals at your hotel, you're not going to go wrong, and then explore.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.